Hello, Sun Sounds listeners. This is Michael Shannon, a volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, reading for Arizona History. Our first story, Mickey Free, tells a story about what really happened to Felix Ward, the kidnapped boy that appeared in the Bascom affair. The 12-year-old boy was tending stock on a ranch in southern Arizona when Apache warriors kidnapped him. Thrust into a new life on that fateful day, January 27, 1861, he lived as an Apache. Wrongly blamed for the abduction, Apache Chief Cochise started a campaign of destruction that lasted more than a decade. The boy became an Army scout known as Mickey Free, described as half Irish, half Mexican, half Apache, and whole son of a bitch. It was meant as praise. Mickey Free was born Felix Martinez about 1848 in Santa Cruz, Mexico. His mother was Jesus Martinez, and his father was a light-skinned, blue-eyed man, probably of Irish descent, named Tellez. In 1858, after Tellez's death, Jesus moved with her children into the Sonoita area of southern Arizona and took up with, though never married, a prosperous farmer named John Ward. In 1861, 12-year-old Felix was tending stock on Ward's ranch when Apache renegades stole 20 head of cattle and took him with them. After the boy's abduction, Lieutenant George Bascom led a command out of Fort Buchanan and tracked down the renegades to Apache Pass. On February 4, 1864, Bascom met the Chiricahua chief Cochise. What followed is known as the Bascom Affair, a much-analyzed incident in which the inexperienced officer brashly and wrongly accused Cochise of taking the boy. The result was a standoff, then shooting. Many died, including some of Cochise's family, whom Bascom had held as hostages. Cochise, bitter at what he considered a betrayal, vowed never to let a white man look upon his face again and live. John Ward and Jesus Martinez never saw Felix again. They died about 1867, believing the boy was dead. But according to author Alan Radborn, who studied Free's life for the English Westerns brand book, the boy was handed over to the San Carlos Apaches, who raised him. Felix Ward came into contact with a whole new way of life, wrote Radborn, and effectively disappeared from the pages of recorded history for over a decade, to eventually emerge as Mickey Free. How Felix Martinez Ward got the name Mickey Free is unknown. One theory is that a bad pronunciation of his Apache name sounded like Mickey Free. In his years with the San Carlos Apaches, Mickey learned to track, hunt, shoot, and kill. He signed on as an Army scout at Fort Verde in December 1872. Army records listed him as 5 feet 7 inches tall and 135 pounds. His pay was $20 a month. In this role, he was to be present at almost every incident of the Apache conflict, from the Battle of the Big Dry Wash to the escape of the Apache Kid and the pursuit of the renegade Victorio. Al Sieber was the Army's famed chief of scouts. At first, Sieber neither trusted nor liked Free, but a bloody incident in Mogollon country in 1875 changed that. Cavalrymen were herding some Apaches from Camp Verde to San Carlos when a snowstorm struck. In a flurry, a horse stumbled into a ravine and broke its neck, and one of its riders, a 9-year-old Yavapai Apache boy, broke his leg. Sieber pulled the boy onto the back of his horse and the group went on. They were hardly started when Sieber felt a sharp pain in his back, wrote A. Kenny Griffith, whose extensive writings on Free's life include a biography. As he jerked around, he felt the pain lessen and saw his own bowie knife flash in the boy's hand for another stab. But Free killed the boy with a knife and then shot the boy's mother in the head as she lunged at Seber with a saber. Twice in the space of a few breaths, wrote Griffin, Mickey Free had saved Al Seber's life. From then on, Seber trusted Fee and relied on him. It was Seber who complimented Free on saying he was half Irish, half Mexican, half Apache, and whole son of a bitch. Once Seber assigned Free to capture an Apache who had murdered a cavalry corporal and fled San Carlos. After tracking him for 300 miles, Free caught the renegade and slashed his throat. But the body was too heavy to haul to the reservation, and Free needed proof of his kill. He carved out the renegade's face and wrapped it in the dead man's jacket. He dropped the rotting trophy at Seber's feet. For his work, Free got a good meal and a bottle of whiskey. Many of the stories told about Free hint of romanticized exaggeration, if not outright fiction. Seber said he could track a shadow on a rainy night, and in his autobiography, Tom Horn called Free the wildest daredevil in the world. A man with fiery red hair, a small red mustache, and a mug that looked like a map of Ireland. A more common description was ugly. Free's left eye was a gray blob cocked at an odd angle, the result of a cataract he developed as an infant. He let his stringy, unkempt hair fall over his face to hide it. In his History of Arizona, published in 1916, J.H. McClintock wrote that Free was about as worthless a pipette as could be imagined, ugly, dirty, unreliable, and dishonest. McClintock was echoing Charles T. Connell, who worked with Free at San Carlos in 1880, and described him as a wandering half-breed whose being caused a woeful events of a decade. Although it was false, the half-breed label stuck, contributing to the view that Free was less than human. But the army valued primitiveness in its scouts. The nearer an Indian approaches a savage state, wrote General George Crook, who chased Geronimo without success, the more likely he will prove valuable as a soldier. Geronimo reviled Free. In May 1885, when the Indian leader broke from captivity at the San Carlos Reservation, Free dogged him relentlessly. He once tracked Geronimo and his renegades 200 miles south from the reservation into Mexico. When Geronimo sat down with General Crook for a peace conference in March 1886, he used his opening remarks to launch a tirade against Free. Geronimo considered Free a liar and a scoundrel and said that he fled San Carlos because Free was plotting to kill him. Geronimo might have been right, but to the army, Free was invaluable. In July 1886, he was chosen to join a group of Chiricahua Apaches who traveled to Washington to lobby for better treatment. It's a difficult sight to imagine. Free, a wild man, meeting with polished bureaucrats, hobnobbing with reporters eager for his translation of various meetings, even shaking hands with President Grover Cleveland. On his return trip to Arizona, the Chiricahua delegation, including Free and other scouts, was arrested and sent to Fort Marion, Florida. More than any other event, this betrayal highlighted the enigma of Free's life. He had done what the army asked of him, yet he was tossed into the stockade with Chiricahuas he had once pursued. After his release, Mickey Free returned to Arizona. In May 1887, he re-enlisted as a scout. It was the only life he knew, and by then he had become a swashbuckling celebrity. He liked wearing his hair in twin braids, with his blue military uniform, cavalry boots reaching above his knees, and a belt around his waist holding two big Dragoon pistols. But fame made Mickey no less vicious. When your correspondent saw Free, his head was in bandages, as he had been badly hurt a few days before while making a murderous assault upon a sergeant of the garrison, wrote a reporter for the St. Louis Globe-Democrat in 1890. After calling him the worst man on the reservation, the St. Louis reporter said Free and his squaw were drunk and made an unexpected attack upon the soldier, but he, being a powerful fellow, succeeded in throwing them off and saved himself by knocking them down with the butt of his gun. Free quit the scouts for good in July 1893. 10 years later, Horn wrote that Free was living on the Fort Apache Reservation with a large Indian family and as wealthy in horses, cattle, squaws, and dogs as he himself puts it. Free married four times and fathered four children. In his last years, Mickey Free was bent over, losing vision in his right eye and racked by tuberculosis. But in Prescott, writer Kenneth Calhoun manuscript on file at the Arizona Historical Society, the cunning tracker had one job left in him. About 20 miles from Free's tin shack, another retired Apache scout and his son-in-law were shot dead when they confronted two cowboys butchering one of their cattle. The old manhunter, hobbled by illness and near death, got his rifle and his knife and rode out. In a few days, Free returned to Fort Apache, leading two riderless horses. He sold the mounts along with their saddles and bridles and gave the money to the widow, but he kept the cowboys' guns and boots for himself. A short time later, on December 31st, 1915, Free was found dead in his shack with a Catholic missal in his hands. It was the final contradiction in the life of a man who took his pay, killed his master's enemies, and survived. That brings us to the end of Mickey Free. Our second story is titled Arizona Place Names. Early Day Settlers Corydon E. Cooley and Marion Clark had been neighbors for a short time, living among the lush green ponderosa forest land along Arizona's Mogollon Rim. The two became concerned about one encroaching on the other's privacy. Perhaps on a clear day one could see a wisp of smoke rising from the other's chimney. Whatever the reason, Cooley and Clark agreed it was getting too crowded, and one of the two parties had to move. The issue was to be settled not by intimidation or gunplay, but with a deck of cards. The game, called 7-Up, where low card wins, was a favorite among frontiersmen. The game reached its climax when Clark said to Cooley, as he dealt the last hand, "If you shows low, you win." At this point, Cooley turned up the deuce of clubs and declared, "Show low it is." Marion Clark moved on down the road a piece, and Cooley named the settlement that grew up near his ranch Sholo, in honor of the now-famous card game. The main street in thriving Sholo today is called the Deuce of Clubs, and whenever there is a runoff for mayor, the issue is settled by the two political opponents sitting down with a deck of cards. The first to draw the Deuce of Clubs is the mayor for the next term. Ever since man first set foot on this land called Arizona, he has felt compelled to name every river, waterhole, mountain pass, and trail. Inspiration was usually drawn from great natural spectacles and awesome beauty, but not always. Among Arizona's fabulous mineral-laden mountains lie the skeletal remains of storied ghost camps of yesteryear, born in boom and died in dust. The fragile wooden walls, concrete ruins, monuments to hopes and aspirations that didn't always pan out. These ghostly reminders of the past were generally populated by a variety of boisterous, rough, and tumble miners, generally characterized as unmarried, unchurched, and unwashed. They named their temporary abodes after former hometowns or countries, girlfriends, local geography, dappled with liberal touch of tongue-in-cheek humor. Others came to the land, promptly renamed or corrupted the original name to better suit their own linguistic abilities. Tucson gets its name from the dark base of nearby Sentinel Mountain. The Papago Indians usually named their communities for some conspicuous geographical feature and called their village at the foot of the mountain, Chukchun. The Spanish pronounced the name Tukishun, which eventually evolved into Tucson. When the early Spanish interlopers asked the river people living along the Gila what they called themselves, their response was Pim, meaning roughly, "I don't understand." The Spanish interpreted Pim to be the name of the tribe, and the Akimil Awatam, or river people, became the Pima. A similar incident occurred at the confluence of the Gila and Colorado rivers. When the Spanish asked to parley with the chief, a young man stepped forward, pounded on his chest, and replied, "Yuma," which meant "son of chief." These people, who called themselves the Keshan, are still more familiarly known as the Yuma tribe, and have a city and county named in their honor. The Apaches' name for themselves was Dene, meaning the people. Apache was a name coined by the Zuni people and popularized by the Europeans. The word means enemy. Navajo comes from similar origin. Closely related to the Apaches, they were dubbed Apaches de Navajo, or Apaches of the cultivated fields. The Spanish weren't the only ones guilty of misinterpretation. sometimes lines of communications falter between peoples of the same language. During the 1880s, Henry Mortimer Cohn became postmaster of a small farming town in the Verde Valley. As was often the case in the birth of a community, the postmaster named the place after himself. In a letter to postal authorities, Mr. Cohn suggested the name Cohnville. Somebody in the nation's capital misread the name and officially dubbed the town Cornville. Down near Organ Pipe National Monument is a junction in the highway. These junctions are usually referred to as Ys. In this case, one road led to Tucson, the other to Ajo, and a third to the Mexican border. When postal authorities asked the folks living at the junction what they wanted to call their community, their response was an emphatic Y. Something was lost in the translation, and with the wisdom known only to bureaucratic minds of officialdom, the name was approved in Washington, giving birth to the town of Why, Arizona, to which some local wag no doubt responded, "Why not?" Eloy is derived from a Syrian word, Eloi, meaning my God. My God is one of those expressions that has many meanings depending on one's emotional response to a situation. If the Syrian who had decided to settle in the area had stepped down from the train in the middle of August, there is little room for doubt as to the intent of his descriptive response. There are names that might be categorized in the department of redundancy. The Spanish attached descriptive names to the landscape, such as Mesa and Picacho. English-speaking people came along and thought the words to be pretty and interesting, but not quite descriptive enough. So Mesa became Table Mesa and Picacho became Picacho Peak. Many of Arizona's communities have misleading names. Pine Top was not named for the famous Ponderosa that abounded in the area, but for a tall, bushy-headed bartender who operated the saloon there in the 1890s. Snowflake was named for the Mormon apostle Erastus Snow and early-day colonizer Jacob Flake. Forepaw, Poland, Cowlick, Hereford, Land, Light, and Love were all named after people. Total Wreck in Pima County became into being in the 1880s when a cowboy named John Dillon discovered a rich core body of silver. The hill above the ridge on which the mineral was discovered was considered by Dillon to be a total wreck. Today, Total Wreck is a ghost town, so there is some truth to the town name after all. Lousy Gulch earned its name not because it was a lousy gulch in the common vernacular, but because the prospectors and miners were attacked by pesky lice, thus providing some power of suggestion to naming the town in honor of the dubious happening. Occasionally, early-day name-givers displayed a noticeable lack of imagination and creativity, such as naming a little green valley near Christopher Creek, Little Green Valley. The same might be said of such obvious place names such as Hilltop, Hillside, Ocotillo, Choya, Cactus, The Gap, Seven Springs, Fish Creek, and Big Bug. There are also some five or six Turkey Creeks scattered around the state and several rattlesnake basins, creeks, hills, and canyons. Arizona's best-known acronym is the range of mountains in Yuma County called the COFAS. COFA stands for King of Arizona, an early-day gold mining operation in the region. The state has been called a land of anomalies and tamales, referring to the many different people and diverse landscapes. There are many times when Arizona registers the nation's high and low temperatures on the same day. People have been known to snow ski and water ski on the same day. There are anomalies in place names, too. The town of Pima is not located in Pima County, but is in the Graham County. The town of Maricopa is found in Pinal County. To make matters even more confusing, the community of Navajo resides in Apache County, while Fort Apache is in Navajo County. Patriotism was the motivating factor in the naming of one of northern Arizona's most prominent cities. The party of immigrants bound for California camped at the foot of the San Francisco Mountains on July 4, 1876. To honor the nation's centennial, they raised the colors. To celebrate the occasion, they called the site Flagstaff. A group of miners in Santa Cruz County wanted to call their new town American Flag, but the idea was nixed in Washington, so the folks settled for Old Glory. In a surge of patriotic fever during World War I, residents of a minor community near Ajo wanted to call their town Woodrow to honor the president. Postal authorities refused to allow the town to be named after a living person, So the townspeople compromised and named the town Rowood. The coming of the Atlantic and Pacific Santa Fe Railroad gave birth to several towns along the main line in northern Arizona. Sandus, Holbrook, Winslow, Seligman, and Kingman were all named for railroad officials or businessmen with a vested interest. The billion-dollar copper towns of Jerome and Bisbee were named for a couple of eastern investors, neither of whom ever took the time to visit their namesake. Women have played a prominent role in the naming of some Arizona towns and places. When polygamy was outlawed in Utah, those Mormons who wished to continue the practice built a community on the Arizona side of the border. They named their town Fredonia. The Free is self-explanatory, and Dona is Spanish for women, thus creating a free woman, or Fredonia, Arizona. Sedona is named for Sedona M. Schnebly, a member of an early pioneer family in the area. Olive City was a small ferry boat crossing on the Colorado River, named to honor Olive Oatman, the young girl taken captive by hostile Indians in the 1850s. Miss Oatman survived her five-year ordeal in the Arizona desert and returned to the white society where she lived a long and productive life. Legend has it, the gold mining boom town of Oatman in Mojave County is also named for Olive. The town of Ruby was named for Little Ruby Andrews, who was one of the community's first few female residents. Black Jack Newman wanted to name the mining community that sprung up near Globe Mima, after his girlfriend Mima Toon. A group of miners who lived nearby hailed from Miami, Ohio. The names Mima and Miami blended together and eventually the latter won out. Mount Lemmon, one of the state's highest mountain ranges and America's southernmost skiing area, was named for Sarah Plummer Lemmon, who was the first white woman to climb to its summit. She made the trek on her honeymoon and made a return voyage when she was 70 years old. Arizona's capital city might have been called Salina, Stonewall, or even Pumpkinville, had it not been for the spurious English lord named Daryl Dupa. Dupa was a well-educated world traveler who, it was rumored, was given a substantial allowance by his wealthy English relatives to remain permanently at large. His raucous lifestyle, highlighted by epic bouts of dipsomania, was no doubt a source of embarrassment to his relatives and contributed to his banishments to Arizona. It was said Lord Dupa was fluent in seven languages. Unfortunately for his listeners, the erudite eccentric spoke all seven in the same paragraph. Dupa was a member of a committee chosen to select a name for the new settlement on the banks of the Salt River one sunny October day in 1870. An intrepid group of entrepreneurs led by Jack Swilling had cleaned out some prehistoric canals dug by the now vanished Hohokam people. An irrigation company had been organized and plans were made to develop farms. Soon, the arid valley would grow crops to supply the military post at Fort McDonald and the mining camps throughout the Bradshaw Mountains. Now they decided it was time to give the place a name. Swilling wanted to call the new settlement Stonewall after his hero, the late Stonewall Jackson. Another member chose Salina for the Salt River. Still another wanted Pumpkinville for the wild pumpkins growing in the area. When Dupa's turn came, he arose and waxed eloquently on the ancient civilization that had once flourished on the land where they were stood. He predicted the rise of another great civilization on the same site. In his inimitable elocutionary style, Dupa compared the phenomenon to the mythical phoenix bird in Egypt that lived 500 years, then rose from its own funeral pyre to flourish again. Needless to say, Dupa's proposal carried the day. Soon after, Lord Dupa gazed wistfully across the Salt River to the mesquite and greasewood-covered desert beyond the river, crossing at Hayden's Ferry, and declared the name reminded him of the beautiful verdant vale of Tempe in Greece. The local folks approved of the analogy, and the dusty Mexican village of San Pablo became Tempe. The name Arizona comes from the Papago Alishonac, meaning small spring. The name became popular following the discovery of rich loads of silver, so pure you could cut it with a knife, some 25 miles southwest of present-day Nogales in 1736. The word was ultimately corrupted to Arizona. The silver didn't last long, but the world now knew of the fabulous Planchas de Plata, sheets of silver, and Arizona. Still, the area was known officially as New Mexico, or better yet, Terra Incognito, during the years of Spanish and later Mexican control. New Mexico became a part of the United States following the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo in 1848, and Arizona remained a part of New Mexico. The Compromise of 1850 brought New Mexico into a union as a territory. Shortly after, the citizens in the western part of New Mexico began clamoring for separate status. Several names were suggested, including Arizona and Gadsonia, the latter to honor James Gadsden, the man who had negotiated the purchase of land south of the Gila River in 1853. The name Arizona won out, and in 1863 there was at last a real Arizona. We Arizonans have inherited a litany of picturesquely whimsical place names bestowed by cowboys, miners, prospectors, and others who arrived in the 19th century, and at least one town can lay claim to its existence from the result of a massive hangover. In the spring of 1876, Charlie McMillan and Theodore Harris had been on a glorious binge in Globe, where the local liquor contained 1,000 songs and 100 fights to the barrel. It was said Charlie was so drunk he couldn't hit the ground with his hat in 3 tries. The next day, he and Dorr were prospecting out north of Globe. Suddenly, Charlie declared he was too ill to proceed and collapsed in deep slumber on the ground. Dorr was a prospector true to the code, which was, roughly stated, whenever and wherever the opportunity arises, take thy pick and hammer and crush rocks. This he did, and somewhere near the body of his sleeping companion, he uncovered a rich load of silver. The fabulous Stonewall Jackson mine was born on the spot. Before the boom ended, some $2 million in silver had been removed. A town sprang up and was called McMillanville in honor of Charlie's $2 million hangover. That brings us to the end of our second story titled Arizona Place Names. This is Michael Shannon, volunteer reader for Sun Signs of Arizona, and this has been the reading of Arizona History. If you missed a program, you can get it on demand at the Sun Sounds website, www.sunsounds.org. Click on Broadcast Info and Audio. Scroll down to the programming links and choose On Demand Broadcasts. Sun Sounds is also available on your smart home device.